Hi, thank you for coming. I'm Corey Field. I'm the current president of the Copyright Society of the USA. And as they say, I just flew in from the coast, and it's great to be here. The hardest part about being president of this group and being in Los Angeles is missing these lunches. And they're just glowing events with the leaders of the bar, present and future. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for being members of the Copyright Society of the USA. We are a completely member-supported organization, if you hadn't thought about that. We depend on our membership for all of our activities. If you have a friend who you could convince to join our distinguished group, please see if that friend would be willing to do so. So without any further ado, as they say, I would like to introduce John Leneau, who's going to introduce today's panel presentation. John, please.
Hi, I'm John Leneau, and I'll be moderating today's panel. Today we'll focus on the ongoing battle between record labels and recording artists and between book publishers and authors over the royalty rates that labels and book publishers are required to pay on sales of digital downloads and e-books under older contracts that predate the digital era. This battle has recently heated up due to the Ninth Circuit's recent decision in FBT Productions versus Aftermath Records, in which the court held that Aftermath must pay M&M's production company royalties on download sales based on 50% of Aftermath's net receipts instead of the contract's lower basic royalty rate. And just 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court denied Aftermath's cert petition. So FBT Productions is now the law of California, at least as interpreted by the Ninth Circuit. The lawyers on today's panel are exceptionally well qualified to address these issues. Brian Kaplan, who is at my far left, is a founding partner of Kaplan and Ross in New York with over 26 years experience litigating entertainment and IP cases. He is lead counsel for the class action plaintiffs in Allman versus Sony BMG, in which plaintiffs seek contract damages on grounds almost identical to those advanced by FBT in the Ninth Circuit case. His amended complaint in that action is in the written materials that are on the Copyright Society website. Emio Zizza, who is next to Brian, is vice president of business and legal affairs at Warner Brothers Records in New York. Before that, he was a business affairs lawyer at J Records and Arista. Emio has negotiated superstar-level recording contracts with many household-name artists. He also teaches law school at Seton Hall and Rutgers and has done so for over 10 years. Steve Gillen, who is to my immediate left, is a partner at Wood, Heron, and Evans in Cincinnati, where he concentrates on book publishing and entertainment. Before entering private practice, Steve worked for nearly 20 years in the book publishing industry. Steve early on recognized the impact that the FBT case would have on ebook royalties and wrote an article on that topic last August, which is in your written materials. Now, I've just given abbreviated biographies for our distinguished panelists. Longer ones are in your materials, so you can refer to those. Now, before the panel debates the FBT case, we thought it would be useful to set up the problem that led to this battle in the first place. Most royalty provisions drafted before the year 2000 were drafted with physical formats in mind. They didn't typically have a specific royalty provision devoted to digital downloads. To figure out what royalty applies to digital downloads under those older contracts, you have to look at the contract's general royalty provisions and figure out which one fits best. The choice usually comes down to two common royalty provisions. The first is the provision that pays the artist a relatively low percentage of the adjusted retail or wholesale price of each record sold. Let's call that the record sold royalty. The other provision is the one paying the artist 50% of the label's net royalty receipts on masters that are licensed to third parties for compilation and other uses. Let's call that the master's licensed royalty. When iTunes emerged as the major digital download store in the early to mid-2000s, the question arose, should artists receive a royalty based on records sold or masters licensed? The difference was dramatic. If paid on the basis of records sold, the artist would receive a royalty perhaps as low as 50 cents on an album sold by iTunes for $9.99. But if paid on the basis of masters licensed, the artist might receive as much as $3 for that same $9.99 album download. In practice, it appears that many labels are paying artists at the lower records sold royalty rate. In response, some artists have claimed that their contracts require payment under the more generous master's licensed provision. The trick, of course, is that not all older contracts are susceptible of such a reading. And to illustrate this point, we collected some sample royalty provisions from old contracts, which are in your written materials. So let's take a short walk, a short trip down the Wayback Machine, through the Wayback Machine. If you don't get the reference to this, come talk to me after the program. Our first stop is to a simpler time in the 1950s, when records were vinyl and had two sides, and when record deals could be drafted in three pages. Hard to believe.
Note the Princeton logo.
In particular, we see that a contract that MGM Records had from the 1950s only provided a royalty for records sold. And even then, it seems to only provide royalties on record configurations that have two sides, whatever that is. One might ask, do digital downloads have two sides? Depending on the answer to that question, I suppose it's possible that MGM doesn't have any royalty obligation to artists on digital downloads under this contract. And if it does have that obligation, it seems pretty minuscule. That is, no more than 5 cents per record sold, regardless of the number of tracks on the record. For our next example, we travel to 1976 and look at the record deal between CBS Records and Superstar's Cheap Trick, which is one of the contracts in a suit that Brian filed. As you might expect from a 1976 deal, there is no download-specific royalty provision in it. Instead, we see a royalty for records sold, which is only payable on records consisting entirely of Cheap Trick tracks sold by CBS or its licensees through normal retail channels. We also see a master's licensed royalty under which CBS pays Cheap Trick 50% of CBS's net receipts for any Cheap Trick master leased by CBS to others for distribution on phonograph records. So, which provision covers iTunes downloads? One could argue that the master's licensed royalty here was intended only for the situation where CBS licenses an individual master for use on a third-party compilation album, and not on the license of an entire album, so that downloads therefore should be subject to the lower records sold royalty. Others, of course, notably Brian, strenuously argue otherwise. And so, until a court decides the issue, it's an open question whether this language would require CBS to pay 50% of net royalty receipts on download sales. For our next example, we travel to 1989 and look at another CBS contract. This one for the Allman Brothers, which is also one of the contracts in a suit that Brian filed. The royalty provisions here are very similar to those in the Cheap Trick deal, except that they contain an additional provision that reduces the otherwise applicable artist royalty by one half for any quote-unquote audiophile record, which it defines as including all digital records. So here, it seems that even if the artist could convince a court to apply the net receipts royalty to downloads, the best the artist might be able to do is to collect only 25% of the label's net royalty receipts instead of 50%. For our next sample contract, we look at a 1994 agreement between a new band and a major label other than CBS, which has been carefully redacted to conceal the contracting parties' identities. Although the contract is worded differently from the CBS deals, substantively, it's very similar to the Allman Brothers language. The only real difference is that this contract provides that the royalty for quote-unquote audiophile records, instead of being one half the otherwise applicable royalty, is the same dollars and cents that would be payable for cassette tapes. Unfortunately, that language might not solve the ambiguity, because the cassette royalty itself can be based on either the record sold or the master's licensed basis. So it seems an open question here as to whether the artist should be paid 50% of net receipts or the lower per record sold royalty. In 1996, we come across a very interesting development. It's a contract between an indie label and an established artist that has a download-specific provision. That provision reads, in the event label sells or licenses third parties to sell records, quote-unquote, embodying the masters hereunder via telephone, satellite, cable, or other direct transmission to the consumer over wire or through the air, the royalty rate applicable in respect of such sales shall be an amount equal to 65% of the otherwise applicable royalty set forth herein, and which royalty rate shall be calculated on the royalty base applicable to compact disc albums embodying such master recordings. To me, this language pretty clearly covers downloads, including downloads sold by third parties like iTunes. It also suggests that the artist royalty on downloads should be based on the records sold royalty rather than the master's licensed royalty, because it expressly refers to the royalty base of CDs, which is a concept that's only relevant to computing a record sold royalty. It is never relevant to computing a master's licensed royalty. So, this 1996 contract language, and any similar language you might see in other contracts, probably avoids the M&M problem. Our last example is the 1998 contract between Aftermath Records and M&M's production company, FBT Productions. Unlike the 1996 contract we just looked at, this contract does not contain download-specific language. To figure out which royalty Aftermath should be paying on iTunes sales, you therefore have to analyze the general royalty provisions. The records sold royalty provision here provides for a base royalty of 18% of the royalty base price on each record sold. And the master's licensed provision says, quote, notwithstanding the foregoing, on masters licensed by us to others for their manufacture and sale of records or for any other uses, your royalty shall be 50% of our net receipts. Now, the panelists will discuss in detail how the Ninth Circuit interpreted these provisions, so I will leave that discussion to them, and I'll also leave this slide up during their discussion. Finally, before turning the discussion to the panel, I want to thank the following people for their help in preparing today's program. Chapter co-chairs Jonathan Puro and Andrew Sparkler, and Vice Chair Ari Abramowitz. program committee members Rich Garza, Pete Binkowski, and Charisma Miller, esteemed society members and friends Michael Pollack, Joe Salvo, and Kate Spellman, and of course, the panelists. I hope this has usefully set up the problem faced in the Ninth Circuit case, and I'm now extremely pleased to turn over the discussion to our distinguished panel, starting with Brian Kaplan. Brian?
Each major record company in the 1970s at one point in time or another developed this 50-50 clause. Each company used somewhat different language in their respective agreements, and that language was tweaked by each of the respective major record labels between the 70s and 90s. The intent, though, behind the language was fairly clear, and that was if the record company had finished its marketing and promotion and manufacturing for a particular project, and that was already in the hopper, and now it was time to make new monies from that project in the equivalent of a turnkey operation, they would provide the master to a non-affiliated third party, and the artist would get 50% of the net revenue received. The language from artist to artist is generally the same with most of the major record companies during the periods of time which they use a standard form agreement. Over years, those standard form agreements were tweaked by each of the majors. But if you look at 8 to 10 to 12 year time frames within each, you'll find a similar clause with a similar intent. And that is, if we, the major, license the master recording to a non-affiliated third party, you, the artist, because we have no new manufacturing costs and no new promotion costs, are going to get 50% of our net because we have no costs involved. Okay, that was the language. That was the intent at the time. It changed and varied from record company to record company. I'll just add one more into the mix to show even within the same record company there could be some significant differences on occasion between the language they employ. I have a case for the Allman Brothers Band against Universal. It's not a class action. It's an individual case. And I'll read you, it'll take half a second, the clause that deals with the 50-50 licensing provision there because it differs from the M&M FBT provision that's been put on the board. With respect to the following records and or exploitation of master recordings, the royalty to be accrued hereunder shall be a sum equal to 50% of PRI's net receipts with respect to such exploitation, and then it gives examples of when the entitlement to 50% is going to be, and it says licenses of master recordings to non-affiliated third parties for sales of records by such licensees. Right. So that was the intent for all of the record companies from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Okay. Now, why is the FBT case important? Well, since the advent of digital technology, all of the labels had a unity of interest in saying to everybody else that, one, their agreement was not intended to cover licenses such as licenses, the agreements with iTunes and Apple, and two, the actual agreements between the majors and the third-party, non-affiliated distributors of digital downloads and ringtones were not licenses. So they had two major arguments to present. FBT deals with both of those arguments. It deals first with the argument as to whether or not the agreement between a major and iTunes is a license or not, and it comes out affirmative. Okay, it applies, and I'll read from the case in a minute, a copyright analysis as to what constitutes a license and what constitutes a sale. And it states, among other grounds, that when the record company continues to own the master, when the rights that are provided to the third party are restricted, and where the record company gets in return a stream of earnings over a period of time, that satisfies all of the elements of what constitutes a license under the copyright and general accepted principles of law. Okay? That decision is of enormous importance because unless another circuit finds a hole in the reasoning of the Ninth Circuit, that should be ultimately law that's adopted in the Second Circuit and other circuits that where contract choice of law provisions exist. So most of the choice of law provisions in recording agreements are generally California law or New York law, and of the hundreds of agreements I've seen over my practice, much more of them are New York than California, but you still have obviously some in California. So you have the Ninth Circuit ruling on this issue, and the Second Circuit down the road will ultimately rule on this issue, unless there's resolutions across the board from class actions as well as individual audit claims, because on an individual audit claim, this is usually a line item claim, and if you don't settle the audit claim, you go to litigation. So even if the Sony BMG class action, which has been settled in principle, reaches fruition, that doesn't foreclose whether or not there will be a judicial determination as to whether a license exists in the overall relationship between the majors and iTunes and the digital download providers. The next phase of the FBT case was looking at the express language of the agreement between the production company for M&M and Universal, or the entities that Universal had relationships with. The 50-50 clause was contained in the initial agreement, and there was a provision, there was a normal retail channels provision that basically said this would be your royalty rate if there are sales through normal retail channels, a fairly standard clause. And then there was a provision that said, notwithstanding the foregoing, anything that's licensed, you're going to be basically getting 50% on. I'm obviously paraphrasing the actual language. The court below, the trial court, was faced with cross motions for summary judgment. And California, which has a much more accepting concept of parole evidence, thought that there was questions of intent and believed that there was some ambiguities in the contract language at issue, and denied cross motions for summary judgment before trial. The case went to trial, and one of the important pieces of evidence at trial was an amendment to the 1998 original agreement that said for purposes of calculating uplifts on the royalty rate for sales of records, meeting a half million or a million threshold would increase your royalty rate, the parties agreed that digital downloads would count in that equation. Now, fuzzing the line between license and sale, because now you're using the arguably licensed use for purposes of calculating an uplift in the royalty rate. Well, the trial court, the jury, came back and they found in favor of the defendants and found that there was no license. On appeal, the Ninth Circuit looked at the contract with the production company and said there are no ambiguities, and it was wrong to have denied summary judgment. And we find that as a matter of law, the contract language employed in the furnishing agreements from the production company required that 50% of all the revenue be shared with the artist. And similarly, as I had already said, they found that the relationship between UMG and iTunes was that of a licensor and licensee. Interestingly, the decision did not quote or even reference, and it's an argument I frequently make, is if you go to subscribe to iTunes today and you read through your subscription agreement, there are so many restrictions on your use. You can't sell your digital file copy of a composition. You couldn't turn it into a secondhand store like you could a physical product. if you read through the restrictions, it's truly a sublicense that's being granted by iTunes to the end user. Well, query, if you can't, there's no way that iTunes can grant a sublicense to the end user unless, in fact, they are a licensee themselves or itself. That argument, I don't know if it was made below, but it wasn't. It didn't leave a lasting impression, obviously, on the Ninth Circuit because it wasn't cited anywhere. I think it's important, since we are a group of copyright practitioners, to at least highlight the case, the court, the Ninth Circuit's discussion of sale versus license, looking at copyright principles, and they say that the sale of a work may either be a transfer in title of any individual copy of a work or a sale of all exclusive intellectual properties in a work. And they cite Section 17 U.S.C. 109 of the Copyright Act describing the first sale doctrine. And clearly here they found that none of the qualities of a sale had been satisfied in the transaction that they were looking at. Next, they said that under case law interpreting and implying the Copyright Act, it is well settled that where a copyright owner transfers a copy of copyrighted material, retains title, limits the use to which the material may be put, and is compensated periodically based upon the transferee's exploitation of the material, the transaction is a license. And they found that all of that criteria had been satisfied. It's interesting to note that nowhere in the UMG, the FBT agreement, was there a definition of the term license. What is the impact of the decision? Well, first of all, the decision is limited in its scope to artists that have the 50-50 clause in their agreements. That 50-50 clause started sometime in the 1970s and ended sometime early 2001, early 2002 in that area. So contemporary artists that sign new deals are going to specifically going to negotiate what their royalty rate is on a digital download and ringtones. Every label uses somewhat different language. So one would have to compare and contrast the actual language used in a recording agreement during the 70s, 80s, and 90s that has the 50-50 clause with the language used in the FBT case to say that it's clear that and unambiguous that it was meant that 50-50 would be split. Again, you don't get to parole evidence unless there is an initial finding of an ambiguity, and we would submit that none of the contracts that we've seen over the years, is there an ambiguity? The record companies would like you to believe there's an ambiguity, but there's no ambiguity. This case has a limited impact because it only affects the artists from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, not the contemporary artists. If you do an audit, you could have settled this claim for various periods of time. Due to the incontestability clause contained in all recording agreements that say that you have to contest a royalty statement within a 2 or 3 year period of time, the older royalty statements would be conclusive and binding unless you were a member of a class action previously filed. And the record companies negotiate digital rates with some of their more important artists, even if their original contracts were in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. With that said, I will pass the baton.
I disagree with everything he just said. I want to amplify some of the points that Brian just made. Specifically, I want to just touch on for a second this March 28th, 2011 article on the front page of the business section of the New York Times, which says, the title says, "Suit Hints at a Bigger Payday for Older Artists." So those of you who haven't seen it, it's worth looking up. But I want to take issue with it because to me that is a sensationalized title, and it's an even more sensationalized article, if you ask me. Touching on what Brian said, I've got a list of five or so issues that I want to take with the impact of the decision. Specifically, we're talking about a Ninth Circuit case. Most record companies, many record companies, have their choice of law is not California law, it's New York law. So there's a limitation there in and of itself on the impact of the decision. Secondly, again, as Brian pointed out, but it bears repeating, the accounting provisions in every recording agreement have limitations, right? You have, generally speaking, a couple of years to object to a statement that you've received, and then you've got a certain window thereafter to either settle it or commence an action. Generally speaking, you're talking about a 3-year or so, give or take, window to bring a claim. So if you haven't yet brought your claim and you brought it today, your window is relatively limited. So there isn't this Pandora's box of money out there for these older artists, as this article and some people would have artists believe. So it bears repeating that also each contract is specific language-wise. And as Brian pointed out, even within Universal's own contracts in that same era, you've got language that is different, right? So every contract is negotiated individually. Yes, we operate out of form, but every form is negotiated, sometimes ad nauseum, depending on who the attorney is on the other side. I'm not naming names. So they have to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. So some people ask me, like, well, does this require you guys to go back and look at every single one of your contracts? No, I'm not looking back at every single one of my contracts. I'm taking them case-by-case as they come up, if they come up. The other thing I want to talk about, again, as Brian pointed out, you're talking about a finite number of contracts that are at issue here. So it's basically, there's this window of artists, let's say 70s to 90s, that are at play. Those that I'm still in business with, and many of the superstars I am still in business with, I've renegotiated that contract several times since the advent of iTunes, and I've clarified the issue. We've come to a settlement of agreement on what I'm going to pay on those sales. So again, this notion that there's this endless supply of artists and contracts that are at issue, I think needs to be scaled back to reality. Lastly, the point I want to make is that as digital sales start to plateau, the amount of money that's at play arguably has, by and large, run its course for that window of artists that we're talking about. So again, I don't want to downplay the issue to say it's not an important one. It certainly is an important one. But to say that this is somehow opening up the coffers of the record companies because here come all these artists, I don't see it that way. I don't think we see it that way as a company. We take it case by case. We take it artist by artist. And just one other point that I want to make on that is that this old language that we're talking about, it's true that this was an ancillary income stream for us back then. We'd already spent our marketing dollars. We'd already spent our promotion dollars. Here, that's not the case. iTunes sales, we are promoting. We are spending marketing dollars. We are the ones putting up the capital. And I would argue it's only right that we make just a little bit more money on that.
Can I just ask a question?
Of course.
You are putting up the marketing monies for iTunes for the acts for their old recordings from the 70s, 80s, and 90s? Or are you doing that with respect to new acts that are coming out?
Obviously, the most money is being spent on new acts. But occasionally on older acts where it matters, when we're reissuing their catalog, when there's a splash of the digital exploitation where it hadn't been before, absolutely there'll be some marketing push. It's not zero.
I've got a question too, if I may.
Please.
Maybe this is more an observation than a question, but it has to have been the case that back when a lot of these contracts were written, that the lion's share of a label's revenue stream came from record sales. And a very small portion of the revenue stream, I would guess, came from these licenses. Would that be fair?
That is absolutely fair. It was an important income stream, but an ancillary income stream.
And the market has changed in a fundamental way since then, and so now very much less of your revenue stream comes from record sales. And so wouldn't this unforeseen event, this migration in the sources of your revenue, wouldn't that have a catastrophic effect on your bottom line if you were paying a 50% royalty on the majority of your revenue as opposed to a small minority of the revenue?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The answer is no.
We'll take it outside later.
I neglected to say when I was done that Universal was slapped with a lawsuit, another class action, on Friday. I'm not the culprit, but it's an action that was filed by the estate of Rick James out in California. So, for those who didn't weren't aware that that took place.
I've got a quick question for Emeo and Brian that has to do with the Ninth Circuit's extreme focus and reliance on the difference between a license and a transfer of copyright under the Copyright Act. And they kind of mechanistically, I thought, applied the definition of license from the Copyright Act to this contract without any clear evidence, so I thought, as to whether the parties intended to use the definition of license from the Copyright Act.
I couldn't agree more, John. Totally agree.
I mean, one interesting flip side of that observation is that almost everything a label does is a license and can be characterized as a license. A physical distribution deal between Sony and its distribution arm is a license from Sony to its distribution arm. So do we now have to apply the 50% net receipts royalty rate to every record that Sony sells, including CDs and other physical configurations?
But the answer to that is no, because under the Sony agreement, for example, when it talks about its affiliated entities as licensees, it's different from a non-affiliated. And since we were talking about the intent going back to the 70s, 80s, and 90s, if you license to your wholly owned subsidiary or affiliate, it was never intended that that should be subject to a 50-50 split, if you get to intent, if you get outside the four corners of the agreement.
Okay, what about non-affiliated record labels that Sony distributes, that Sony's distribution arm distributes? Are those licenses, and do those independent labels now have to pay their artists 50% of their net royalty receipts on sales of CDs because their distribution agreement with Sony's distribution arm, is an unaffiliated third-party license?
It would depend upon the specific language of the agreement that the smaller record label had with its artist, obviously.
No.
Okay. I guess what I'm getting at is there any reason that the Ninth Circuit should have sort of mechanistically applied the difference between a license and a transfer of title to its interpretation of the Sony contract, the CBS contracts? I don't mean the CBS, I mean the UMG contracts.
I think that if they had looked beyond the Copyright Act and had looked at general case law interpreting license versus sale, they would have come up with the same conclusion.
I noticed in looking at the Ninth Circuit opinion that the court made a number of references to the Copyright Act where license was clearly distinguished from sale. I also noticed that they didn't point to Section 101 definition of transfer of copyright ownership, where that definition includes not only the sale of an interest or assignment of an interest, but also the grant of an exclusive license. So muddying the water a little bit. It also occurs to me.
So a license can be a transfer, is what you're saying.
That's right. So it's not, you know, it's not all one-sided in the Copyright Act. I think it's also the case that there isn't. It isn't. necessarily the right result to look for that fine a distinction in the contract. I think that in the age of things software and things digital, that it's common to confuse or to conflate sale and license. And so while there are very good reasons why we don't sell software, we license it, or we don't sell things digital, we license them, it's very common in common parlance to talk about that transaction as a sale. And the court didn't talk about that.
Okay, I think we're going to move on to the book publishing industry. And
before we change subjects completely, why don't we see if there are questions about the music aspect of this?
Fine with me. I see a hand in the back.
Eric.
Anybody know what happened to trial?
Eric's question was, does anyone on the panel know why the record company prevailed after a full trial on the merits when the Ninth Circuit found that the contract was unambiguous on its face?
Well, once the judge denied the cross motions for summary judgment and found that there was an ambiguity, it was now a jury question. What was in the jury's minds, one would only know if you polled the jury after the case was over. But it would seem to me that a pretty compelling piece of evidence to go in front of a layperson would be that this bump up in royalty rate for when digital downloads were added to sales to confuse a juror into thinking, well, they must be then one and the same, and how could you call it a license for one use and a sale for another? So that would be my guesstimate, not having sat through the trial.
Yeah, I haven't seen the trial record, but I do know that all kinds of parole evidence was introduced to the jury. It could have involved conversations between the lawyers. Who knows what custom? I believe there was custom in the industry evidence also admitted, and that obviously swayed the jury into thinking that the intention of the parties was to pay downloads at the per record sold rather than the licensed master rate. Yes.
I have a question regarding the settlement without obviously getting into the specifics. Record company agreements often have as short as a 1 year, private statute, sometimes two, never exceeding three. So I'm wondering, when you settled with Sony, did you settle just on behalf of the Allman Brothers? Or so what is the status of the class action?
Yeah, I can't give any of the particulars, but I will tell you that I did a, just to give you some guidance on how these things work, I did a prior class action for Gary Puckett in the Union Gap against another major, and various members of the class had incontestability clauses that went from 1 year to 3 years, and I believe in that case we reached a compromise of 2 years as being the cutoff. So if we filed that case in 1996, then we could go back to 1994 for the entire class.
And did the Sony matter?
We're not there yet.
Mm-hmm. Any other hands before we go on to? Yes, right, yeah. In front.
Emilio, you commented on the limitation on the liability for record companies based on these contract provisions. You didn't address the actual ruling itself. I know you addressed it in a sense where you're talking about an equity argument about the majority of the revenue now that used to be ancillary, maybe now the majority of the record company's revenue. But what about the actual ruling of the structure of the deal between, say, iTunes and a label? Any comments on whether you feel that's a license or a, I know you really probably can't admit that, but do you feel that it's more of a licensing relationship or do you think it's more of a sale relationship?
Personally, I think it's, as was touched on earlier, it's more about custom and practice to me in the sense that there's always been this sort of license relationship, whether it's iTunes that we're talking about or whether it's Warner and WEA. And so to me, it's really about what the industry norms are. And that, I think, leans in favor of where we, our position, which is on the sales side of things.
Okay, we'll open the floor again at the end of Steve's presentation on book publishing. So if additional questions occur that you want to ask about the recording industry side of this panel, please feel free to hold them till then.
Okay. I'm going to set up.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. So I'm the odd man out up here. I'm not from New York, first of all. I'm from out of town. And secondly, I'm not here to talk about the music business. I'm here to carry this conversation forward, or maybe I should say carry it backward to book publishing, because the same thing is in the offing, I think, for book publishers. But we're running a little behind the curve. E-book sales are growing rapidly. The most current numbers that I have are from the third quarter of 2010, and you can see that there was 112% increase year on year, but the jump really started three quarters back at the end of the 2009 season. Nevertheless, e-books still trail the growth in digital sales in the music business. E-book sales are only about 5% of a $24 billion book market. The growth in e-book sales now is running at 70-plus compound annual growth rate, but even at that rate, it's going to take at least 5 years to catch up with what's happened in the music business. Some other book numbers that might be of interest: 174 million books ever published since the start of humankind, 42 million of those in the current collections of Google's five partner libraries, roughly 25 million of those still under copyright, and of those 25 million, 2 million still in print. But about 20 million of the books still under copyright protection were published before 1990. That's a pretty significant body of work that represents a potential problem with respect to this issue, because they were originally contracted for under pre-1990 contracts that didn't really anticipate the development, the evolution of the e-book. We've talked about this case. This is really a contract question. I know I've got a room full of copyright lawyers here, but the issue is a contract issue where we have to talk about the meaning of license versus sale. We have to decide, is that a question of fact? Is it a question of law? We have to look at whether or not in the contracts there are integration clauses, because that may have an impact on the court's willingness to look outside the four corners of the agreement. We have to think about the impact of ambiguity. There's a general rule of construction that says that ambiguities are going to be resolved against the drafter. Well, who was the drafter? And if there was some negotiation in the contract, is that really a rule that we're going to fully apply? We have to look at the intent of the parties, but that's a problem too, because here, you know, it can't be said that in 1973 any of the parties to one of those contracts had any intention with respect to how e-books would be treated. Now, it might be fair to say that they had perhaps some intention about how they would allocate amongst themselves the risk of the emergence of a new technology that they didn't anticipate, but I think even that's a bit of a stretch. And then, of course, we have to think about the admissibility of parole evidence. All of this happens in a state law context, so answer in one state might not be the answer in another state. Some generic rules of construction. I know this is pretty small. It's in your handout. I say generic rules again because what we're talking about here is contract law, and it varies from state to state. So I can't give you a list of which rules of construction are going to relate, are going to apply to your situation. But just for example, the construction of a written contract is a matter of law for the court. The primary task is to ascertain and give effect to the intent of the parties. Well, we've talked about that and whether there really was any intent or what it might relate to. A contract that's clear and unambiguous will be enforced as written. If the writing is clear, the court presumes that the party's intent resides in the words in that agreement. When a contract is susceptible to two or more reasonable interpretations, that is, if it's ambiguous, resolution of the ambiguity is for the trier of fact. But in practice, I think that ambiguities will be resolved by the court if the rules of construction make it possible for them to do that without handing it over to the jury. Giving terms their ordinary meaning. You know, when we say sale license, are we talking about sale versus license as it's handled in the copyright statute? Are we talking about sale versus license the way people talk about selling software? The law is presumed to be part of the contract. I think that the Ninth Circuit was taking that to heart when it looked to the copyright statute for guidance about drawing distinctions between license and sale. Construing an ambiguity against the drafter, we've talked about that. Construing a term in the context of other terms. With respect to the M&M case, it occurs to me that maybe we have a new rule of construction. If you're a record label lawyer in the Ninth Circuit, maybe you don't put the word notwithstanding at the beginning of the sentence that has your highest royalty rate. Maybe that's the new rule of construction. If extrinsic evidence is required, some courts refer this issue to the fact finder. Others work to resolve the ambiguity. You read the contract as a whole. There's this concept called practical construction, which sometimes causes the court to look at how the parties behaved with respect to that contract post-deal. So how did they behave after the fact? Well, what impact does that have with respect to what publishers may be doing now, what record labels have done in the past with respect to amending the contracts that they have in place or substituting new forms for old forms? Is it possible now for the artist, the creative, to say, hey, look, this publisher changed the language that indicates to me that they knew that the language that they had before wasn't sufficient. It's post-contract conduct, but it has an impact, a bearing on what they might have intended with respect to the original. So let's take a look at some language from some representative book contracts back over the last quarter century. In around 1973, the Authors Guild promoted a recommended trade contract as if the authors ever had enough leverage to use their own contract form. But it treated this issue this way. It said, publisher shall pay author the following royalties on each copy of the trade edition sold by the publisher. So that's copy sold, but a copy of what? Copy of trade edition. Is that inclusive enough to include an ebook? That's a good question. The other provision, of course, the competing provision, gross proceeds of any license granted by the publisher for use of subsidiary rights shall be divided as follows, usually 50-50. In 1977 trade book contract, the publisher shall pay the author royalties at the following rates for sales of the trade edition. Here again, we've got trade edition as opposed to copy. Does that signify an intention to be less inclusive? And then the competing provision dealing with disposition of secondary rights. An 85 trade book contract, the publisher shall pay to the author a royalty on the retail price of every copy sold by the publisher. That appears to be pretty clear, but copy of what? You know, it doesn't say trade edition, it doesn't say book, it doesn't even say, it doesn't say copy of what. And the competing provision, again, dealing with disposition of licenses and paying 50%. In 2000, we've got a trade book contract. Now, this one has a peculiar turn of phrase at the beginning. It says, for so long as copyright protection in the work subsists in the U.S., the author will earn the following royalty. That sounds to me a little bit like a boast. I don't know how it strikes you. Again, we're talking about copies sold, but interestingly here, now the publisher is beginning to anticipate the coming of some sort of digital book, and so they talk about copies sold by the publisher in any tangible electronic medium. So they're talking about books on disk, I suppose. You can see that the rate here is 14 to 18%. They go on to talk about publishers authorizing access, so they're not using license language here, but authorizing access by end users to any of its electronic editions. And then they made what in my mind is a horrible mistake, agreeing that this would be negotiated in good faith in the future, thereby guaranteeing that they would be at loggerheads for perpetuity. I'm sure that they have yet to agree on how those rights will be treated. And then finally, the author will earn a royalty of one half of the net amount received, the 50% share, on any license in any medium published by another, licensed third-party license. 76, textbook contract. The publisher shall pay to the author the following percentage on copies sold, on licenses used. This one, interestingly, says on uses of subsidiary rights by the publisher. So this now is not even a third-party license where this publisher is agreeing to pay 50%. A 1988 textbook contract that talks about copies sold and talks about the right to license. That seems to be reasonably clear, but again, it doesn't say copies of what. a 1991 textbook contract that talks about sales by it, sales by the publisher of copies of the work, and then the subsidiary rights licensing language, transfer seller license to others. A 2002 professional book contract. Now, this publisher has really boxed himself in regular sales in the U.S. of cloth-bound editions. Okay, so it's going to be pretty hard to read ebooks into that. Interestingly, this publisher, you know, we talk about the variation in contract law. Now, a lot of publishing contracts pick New York as the choice of law, but this one picked the law of the District of Columbia. Good luck with that. You know, I'm sure they have a big body of well-developed contract law in the District of Columbia. On the other end of the transaction, we have two models evolving now in book publishing. Originally, we started with the licensing model that adopted by Amazon and then by Google, and then we have a new model coming to the fore, an agency model that's been adopted by Apple. The Amazon agreement uses traditional license language. It talks about a grant of rights. It says, you hereby grant to us a non-exclusive, irrevocable right and license, and then it lists, there's a laundry list of things that sound like copyright rights being licensed. And the Google Books Partner Program is a little more obtuse. It doesn't use the word license, but it speaks in terms of Google having permission to scan, store, and display. Again, sounds a lot like a license, even though they don't use that terminology. And then finally, we have the agency model, which calls itself not a license, but terms and conditions. And it says the publisher hereby appoints the agent as its non-exclusive agent for the marketing and delivery of ebooks. So we have an agency appointment. We have a certain set of duties that the agent is going to have. We talk about an agency commission rather than a royalty. We talk about conditioning the use of the ebooks not on an end user license, but on an end user's acknowledgement of terms of use. We have the parties agreeing that the nature of their relationship is principal and agent. And we have the agent agreeing to limits on its authority as agent. I think an attempt to deal with the law of unintended consequences, or maybe to forestall them. The agency model goes on to use an end-user form that's styled, as I said, as terms and conditions, not as an end-user license. But we are talking about a digital version here, and so there's some concern about selling it or suggesting that you're selling it. So we don't use the words sell or buy. Instead, we talk in terms of delivery of the product. As these are contract issues, we've got statutes of limitations. Again, variations in state law mean the statute of limitations may range from 3 to 15 years. Most of these contracts do have choice of law provisions. Some of them don't, and if they don't, then you know, good luck figuring out what statute is going to apply to your situation. I'm from the Sixth Circuit. In the Sixth Circuit, we have things that happen that don't happen out here to the rest of you. And we had a case about 15 years ago between a publisher and author of a children's illustrated Bible. And they anticipated that they might at some point down the road have disagreements about that contract that they were about to enter. And so they wrote some language into that agreement that said, God in his word forbids Christians to bring lawsuits against other Christians in secular courts of law, and God desires Christians to be reconciled to one another. And so instead of having recourse to secular courts, they agreed that they would come together and pray together and purpose to be reconciled. Well, you know what happened, right? You can see the case citation at the bottom of the page. The publisher stopped paying the author. The author immediately sued the publisher, and they spent the next several years up and down the circuit arguing about whether this was a mandatory arbitration provision or not, and never getting to the substantive issue. So don't take that approach. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. We have a few minutes left to entertain any questions from the audience on either book publishing or sound recordings. Fred?
For Steve, I think the book publishing contract dating from the hard copy era contained a reversionary clause that if the book goes out of print after certain notice and other requirements are met, the rights granted to the publisher will revert to the author. And I wonder what your thought is on when an e-book goes out of print.
Well, that's a good question. It's something that I'm sure folks will be arguing about. But the reversionary clause in most publishing contracts is not self-executing. As you point out, the author does have to take some step to reclaim the right, and authors oftentimes have lost interest at that point, or they don't even know that it's going out of print. And so there are a lot of situations, I think, where a book is not in print, where the author might have a right to reclaim the rights but hasn't done that.
But is there a contractual, is there a court interpretation of what out of print means now in the age of digital books?
If there is, I'm not aware of it. I think that publishers use, in that provision as in other provisions, the publishers that have written those contracts for the most part use language that's oblique. That doesn't sharply define when a book is out of print. That leaves a lot of that to the reasonable judgment or discretion of the publisher. I think that if they act unreasonably, you know, they could be successfully called to task. But you know, what's the likelihood of that being of sufficient economic merit that anybody is ever going to press it? Because by definition, the publisher isn't interested in the book because it's not selling anywhere. And what author has the wherewithal to pursue something just on principle?
But the purpose also behind that provision was to get back your rights if it was no longer available. So if it's available through digital, it's still available. Whether anyone's buying it or not, it's a different question.
Right. I've heard authors complain that a book can no longer go out of print because as long as it's available electronically. So it seems to me that authors seem to think that's the law. Whether that is, you know, how a court would interpret it or not, I don't know. But that seems to be how authors are interpreting it. I see a hand. Yes.
Well, that's a good question. I don't know that I have an answer that's going to satisfy you. I think that publishers are not likely to relinquish the control over their works to distributors beyond what they're required to do. You know, I think that the whole reason for licensing books is to not have to deal with the first sale doctrine. Certainly that leaves the publisher with one foot on the boat and one on the dock when it comes to trying to interpret those e-book transactions into the copies sold language.
Over here.
Yeah, in the FBT decision, you had the court looking at the agreement between Universal and iTunes and determining that specific agreement was a license, and even implying approvingly that iTunes or Apple may be selling records to consumers, but it's Universal that was licensing masters to iTunes. What's to stop the record companies from just engaging the next time the iTunes agreement comes up for negotiation, taking the agency approach that the book publishers are taking, and just eliminate this entire decision at least as it affects, you know, royalties going forward?
I've taken the position in intellectual discourse, if you can call it that, and saying if it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, smells like a duck, it's a duck.
It's so a three-part duck test, very simple.
So just because you call it, I mean, you could slap agency on the front of the present agreement and alter one or two clauses and now try to pass it off as an agency agreement.
Except the entire case was based on the fact that they had slapped license on the terms of the agreement as opposed to agency.
No, it's not called a licensing agreement. The
agreement with iTunes used the word license masters, or arguably it was using the terms of licensing masters. But anyway.
There was a conclusion based upon the legal rights that were being conveyed or restricted, and I think that you'd find the same rationale even if the label tries to change some of the wording. The restrictions would still apply. I argued when we had an oral argument in the Sony case that if Sony had its own affiliated entity that was the provider, that based upon the Sony contract language, that and it wasn't a third-party provider, that we wouldn't have had the same claim if it had been their own affiliated entity. But when it's a third party, that's a different story.
Okay, it's 2 o'clock. Steve, did you want to make one comment?
Nope, time's up.
Time's up, okay. Thanks very much, and thank you for our panel.